Honorable Andrew Young.
Thank you very much. I need to take Dr. Joseph with me. Every time he says something good about me, or every time he's given me a piece of advice, he and Mary have been a blessing in my life. And when I was asked to come here, there was not a moment's hesitation, for I feel indebted to this institution for educating my baby daughter. And I also have enjoyed and been very proud of your dealing with the struggles of the 21st century. Almost everything that needs to be said has been said, and it's been said very well. But I didn't come here just to sit down and shut up, but I won't be quite as long as my friend Harry Belafonte. Harry Belafonte is a treasurer who really, like Jim Joseph, has pushed me into some of the best things I've ever done. When Martin Luther King was killed, we were meeting the day before he went to Memphis with Harry and John Conyers and Dick Hatcher, and we were talking about how to take the energy and vitality and spirit of the civil rights movement into politics so that we didn't have to march every time something went wrong or go to jail or get beaten up. We ought to have people of goodwill elected to public office, and nobody wanted to run for the Congress in Georgia. And I was discussing it with Harry, and he didn't even ask. He turned around and he picked up the phone and he called his wife, Julie, and he said, get Sidney and Lena on the phone and see if we can find a date. And she evidently said, what for? And he said, Andy is going to run for Congress. Sidney was Sidney Poitier and Lena was Lena Horne. And they were joined by Alan King, and before I even had a time to talk to my wife or my children or even think about it myself, I had a congressional campaign going, and they were putting on a $100 plate dinner, which in 1970 was a whole lot of money, at the Pierre Hotel in New York. And so I'm always indebted to Harry for pushing me into politics, for it has been an enjoyable experience. But let me advise you, don't ever want to go. Being a politician is like being a preacher or a professor. Don't do it if you can get out of it. If you can do anything else. But my life with Martin Luther King was constantly a blessing and still is a blessing. And your association and the benefits that have accrued to you from the life and ministry of Martin Luther King have been and will continue to be a blessing to you. If you can take the time to try to understand in depth what Martin's ministry was all about. He happened to be an African American. But we are not celebrating this day because he was an important, famous African American. There are many distinguished African Americans, many of whom equally merit recognition and a holiday. Several others have won Nobel Prizes, Ralph Bunche, for instance. The thing that's significant about Martin Luther King for me, and I think for you, is that he looked at the troubles of the world and he said, "We shall overcome." But we can only overcome the troubles of the world by nonviolent means. That our society is plagued by triple evils of racism, war, and poverty. And they are inextricably bound. Because of the insecurities of racism, we help to keep people poor. We end up creating conflicts with people who are different, and we go to war. So we have got to find a way to deal with these evils in order that our society might fulfill its true destiny. And we must deal with them in our own lives in order that we might be the people that we were created to be by the living God. I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana, and it was a blessed neighborhood. I had an Irish grocery store on one corner, an Italian bar on another corner, but on the third corner was the German-American Bund. And I grew up in the 30s, and so it was not unusual for me to pass there on a Saturday afternoon when they were meeting and hear people 50 yards from where I was born, heiling Hitler. My father was a dentist, and many of the people who he depended on for his dental supplies happened to be Jewish. And so my house, even for a four-year-old, was a constant table of conversation around the horrors of racism and potential genocide. And my father took me to the movie theater, segregated though it was, to see Jesse Owens win four gold medals in the 1936 Olympics. And he said, "You see, this is the way you deal with white supremacy. You don't argue about it, you don't get angry, it's a sickness. You have to prove in your own life that it's at best irrelevant and that there's no way you can let these archaic notions of other people's insecurity. In fact, it's a sickness. And you don't get angry with sick people, you help them." And so that's the context in which both Martin Luther King and I were born. Daddy King, to his death, refused to be angry, refused to be bitter. He said over and over again, "I'll not let any man reduce me to hating him. That hatred is too great a burden to bear." My father put it another way, "Don't get mad, get smart. If you get angry in a fight, you lose the fight. And freedom is a constant struggle, and your mind and your spirit is your most valuable weapon." He was preparing me for the nonviolence of Martin Luther King, which we didn't understand then. But just as we were both entering college, I went to Howard University and he went to Morehouse. Gandhi came on the scene with the independence of India through nonviolent means. So our college generation was all reading Gandhi with excitement. I frankly felt it wouldn't work here. And it was a little too idealistic. And yet, I was proved wrong. Nonviolence will work here on any and every issue, and it will work everywhere. And unless you believe in that possibility, you're doomed to a life of cynicism and frustration. We are put here on this planet to perfect creation. And we do that in many ways. And what Martin Luther King said was, we are going to break down the barriers that prevent us from having an equal opportunity to address the problems. He never said he was going to get rid of racism, he was going to get rid of poverty, he was going to get rid of war and leave us with the kingdom of God here on earth in our lifetime. He said we can break down these barriers that make one group artificially superior and another group artificially inferior, as President Broadhead so eloquently put it. And when we break down those barriers, we can come together as brothers and sisters. And together, we have an opportunity to resolve almost any problem around the table. And so your selection of a theme for this exercise is quite appropriate. Come to the table. The old spirituals would say, bring your burdens to the Lord and leave them there. Bring your problems to the table. Bring your troubles to the table. Bring your anxieties and insecurities to the table. And there around the table, we can deal with them as brothers and sisters. But they won't go away. They are part and parcel of the fabric of humanity. But don't get disillusioned about that. Our Roman Catholic brothers call it original sin, and a lot of Baptists like that too. That makes me very uncomfortable. There is something about humanity that is challenged by differences. And until we overcome our own insecurities about who we are threatened by others with different opinions, with different lifestyles, with different almost anything. And I noticed that I grew up with the hippies. And they used to get on my nerves. And I decided one time out in San Francisco, the reason that they got on my nerves was by that time I was married and had two kids and had to live a responsible life. And I resented the daylights out of them to be able to live free and do what they wanted to do. And it was not their problem, it was my problem. And that's the basis of when you find anybody getting you mad for any reason in any situation, don't look at them, look inside. Now, what is it in me that is making me react this way? Now, it was worse than that before 1964. The insecurities of humanity had been institutionalized into laws. And so we not only had to deal with the theological and psychological problems, which you will have to deal with, we had a legal problem that prevented us from even addressing the psychological and theological problems. There was a legal and economic system that prevented us from facing up to the realities of our own humanity. Frankly, I think we did very well about that. but in breaking down those dividing walls of hostility, we really opened ourselves to new problems. Because along with our progress and prosperity was the progress of technology, was the presence of television, the presence of later on the internet, the globalization of our economy and of our technology. And so in 1960, we could focus on human rights in the South. But by 1970, we had to address the problems of human rights in the Soviet Union. We had to address the problems of human rights in South Africa. We had to address the problems of human rights in Latin America. We had to look at the problems of human rights in China, that almost every issue that bothered us suddenly became global, and we could no longer deny it. And because of the globalization of our value system, we find ourselves in a much more complex time. And that's why your education, your research, your involvement in an institution like this is of even more significance. Because we have to solve these problems not only for ourselves, but for the entire planet. When there is a threat to justice anywhere, it becomes a threat to justice everywhere. That was a truism for Martin Luther King. But it's an economic reality. When there's a trouble in the oil fields of Nigeria, the price of oil goes up. When there's a problem in the Middle East, the price of oil goes up. When we end up having a way of bringing about peace and prosperity for a period of time, prices tend to level off in one area, but they go up in another area. You almost have to be a macroeconomist to get by month by month. And that challenge makes every problem we've had more difficult. When Atlanta began to be sort of the mecca of civil rights and human rights, and I found myself as mayor, I also found that the money had run out in Washington. And there was no possibility of going to Washington and ask the federal government. They were deeper in debt than anybody else. And so you had to do, what was it, Willie Sutton, who said, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. So I had to begin to look to where the money was, and I found that there was money in Japan. There was money in Europe. There was money from the oil-producing nations that had been put in holding companies and trust all over the world, and I had to go where those pockets of prosperity were being saved. And I had to challenge the people of the world to come and invest in the South of the United States. I had to do that, even though it was very controversial. But there was no way a mayor of Atlanta or a mayor of Raleigh and Durham or anywhere else could survive just on the basis of the taxes generated by your own citizens. There had to be a growth model. And so we made an effort to invite Japanese businesses in, invite German businesses in, invite the Dutch. The Dutch are great traders, and they bring their money. We attracted $1.5 billion of Dutch money. Where did that come from? I don't know. But they invested it in Atlanta, and it created jobs. They helped us to revitalize our economy. And in the 8 years, we brought in $70 billion worth of new investment and 1,100 companies from all over the world. We then globalized our economy. And then what do you do? Well, to keep it going, we had to go after the Olympics. And so one of the reasons why we're making it in this region is we understand that almost every problem is an opportunity. And every opportunity has to be at least thought about globally. If we're going to end poverty in North Carolina, we're going to have to consider poverty in China and poverty in India. And if we don't consider poverty in those parts of the world, we're going to have wars that affect the economy and the poverty levels here. And so we are a part of a global economy, whether we like it or not. I guess Tom Friedman in The World is Flat probably does as good a job of documenting that as any. But I didn't have to read that book. I just had to walk along the streets of Shanghai and have Chinese young people come up to me and say, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Oh, it's wonderful. These high school kids are practicing their English." And I said, "Atlanta, Georgia." And they said, "Empire State of the South." And the lady with me said, "Well, I'm from South Carolina." He said, "Oh, you're a Tar Heel." She said, "No, that's North Carolina." And he scratched his head and he said, "Is that the Palmetto State?" Now, these are high school kids in China. And not only did they know more about the United States than I did, because I didn't know what South Carolina was, but as ambassador to the United Nations, when the Chinese delegation came back in, just about everybody there was very, very well versed in all of the subtleties and sensitivities of American politics. And so anything we do, we're going to have to compete on a global basis. Oprah Winfrey has decided to develop her own model of ending poverty. She went to the poorest areas of South Africa, picked kids in shanty towns and huts, and then put them in a school that looked like it was designed and built as a Ritz-Carlton five-star hotel. Well, even people in South Africa complained and said, "That's wrong. Why do you waste all that money on these poor kids?" And then it suddenly dawned on me. Education, even in America, came out of our Puritan heritage or out of our Catholic sacrificial heritage. And for the most part, we expected teachers to be poor. When my mother was teaching, teachers couldn't even get married. They had to be single. And when they got married, they had to quit teaching. We associated education with poverty, with being Spartan and Puritan. The schoolhouse was bare, and we never invested much money in education. And there's something wrong with that. Oprah decided she was going to invest in children. And not only did she decide to invest in children, she decided to invest in children just like her. And remember, billionaire though she is, she was a poor kid from rural Mississippi who almost got sent to the detention home because she was bad. And if she had not been, if the detention home in Milwaukee had not been overcrowded, she would have gone to jail. Instead, because of overcrowdedness, they didn't let her in. And to get rid of her, they sent her to her father. And her father said, "As a barber, you can stay here, but you have to come in here every evening after school, and you have to sit down and read. And you have to make A's and B's, because you don't have a C mind." And she saw the transformation that came to her as a result of somebody telling her that she had a good mind and she had to exercise it. And now she's decided that she's going to do the same for 500 children in South Africa. Now that's a revolution. It's a revolution because you take the poorest of the poor and you treat them like they're rich, and they're going to act like they're rich. If you take it one at a time and make them think they're rich, they will start being rich and forget about the poor. But by taking 400 or 500 and by bringing 100 new girls, 75 new girls into this school and graduating them every year, you're going to see a transformation of the concept of education. And it won't take but 10 or 15 years. We have a public policy school that I work with at Georgia State, and 2 years ago we graduated 6 Mandela Fellows. They happened to be young women from South Africa who got their PhD degrees. They were all in their late 20s and early 30s. It took them about 6 months to get located into the South African government. They're in the Ministry of Finance, the Ministry of Transportation, the Ministry of Tourism, the Ministry of Education. And 6 young black girls who were locked into apartheid, suddenly being given the power of one of the thriving economies in the world today, is going to create a kind of revolution. Oprah's 500 girls are 10 to 15 years away from global leadership. But Muhammad Yunus in Bangladesh won a Nobel Prize doing the same thing. He found that the way to deal with poverty in Bangladesh was not from the top down, but by giving microcredit to beggar women. And he said when he sat down and talked to these women who were begging, it was almost as though each one of them, in their own mind, had a dream, which, with a little encouragement, they spelled out into a fairly sophisticated business plan, working with beggar women in Bangladesh for 20 years. Muhammad Yunus has developed the Grameen Bank, which is now an $8.5 billion facility. And he thinks still, working from the bottom up, that if they can expand the opportunity, the access to capital to the poor in Bangladesh, that they can end poverty in Bangladesh by 2030. Martin Luther King's notion of ending racism and poverty and war is still very, very relevant. But it would have helped if our president had kind of understood that affirmative action is a necessary part of that. That you can't give benefits to one group of people and not protect the benefits of the other. And if we had gone into Iraq differently, and then when we got there, respected the differences and insecurities of Kurd and Sunni and Shia, and if we had a constitution that protected their minority rights, we might have avoided significant bloodshed. Believe it or not, we are ending poverty on the planet Earth. But the ending of poverty is not coming from the United States. Poverty is pretty static here. It's coming from India and China. And in China, everybody was poor, and they have their own way of doing things. But in India, there's an affirmative action effort for the untouchable class, that in public universities, fully half of the seats are now being guaranteed for untouchables. And they understand that India, in order to thrive, has got to make sure that the people on the bottom don't lose hope and continue to have opportunities to grow for themselves and their children and to participate in solving India's problems. Yes, it is an exciting world. Tom Friedman also has the McDonald's theory of world peace, now supplemented by the Dell supply chain theory. And he figures when anybody gets caught in a Dell supply chain, China being the example, that it's worth about $40 billion to them and hundreds of thousands of employees. And if they started a war, it would end the supply chain, so don't ever worry about China starting a war. He also says, so far, and still it's true, that no two countries that have a McDonald's have ever gone to war with each other. That there's something about the level of consumerism that when you get involved enough in the economic life of a community to pay the bills and want to take your family to McDonald's, even though I know the health program doesn't approve of that. that it is a vehicle for peace. But maybe the most striking example of the possibilities of peace without violence is in the place that seems to be the most difficult. Right now, Jimmy Carter is under some significant criticism for a book that he wrote about Israel, Peace or Apartheid. And regardless of whether you like it or agree with it, it's important to face the fact that the only peace that Israel enjoys is a peace between Egypt and Israel that Jimmy Carter implemented. That since 1978, no Egyptian has killed any Israeli, and no Israeli has killed any Egyptian. And so what Jimmy Carter did in 1977-78 has worked. What everybody else is saying before and since, nobody has worked to produce peace in the region since Ralph Bunche and then Jimmy Carter. So we can't discount what Jimmy Carter is saying without looking into the situation as it presently exists. But we can argue about that from abroad. But in the meantime, one of the most beautiful stories I have heard in recent years, even in the Atlanta Constitution last week, an Israeli soldier mourning the death of his sister by a Hezbollah rocket, put on civilian clothes, and went through the barriers into the Palestinian community looking for Palestinian militants and confronting them with the notion, can't we stop the killing? And isn't it possible for us to find ways to live together? And he was pleasantly surprised that he found Palestinian soldiers who wanted to come to the table to discuss the same issues. We can't give up on the possibilities of peace. We can't give up on the hope of ending poverty. We can't give up on our learning to deal with our insecurities and our racism. We can't give up. That's the message of Martin Luther King, that freedom is a constant struggle, and that what we are trying to do is to work out the mechanisms that we can struggle together without violence, and that we can solve the problems of humanity for ourselves and for generations yet unborn. When I was at the United Nations, a group of Indian chiefs from the Mohawk Nations came to see me, and they said, we are an independent, sovereign nation, but we happen to be on the same landmass that you're representing. And so we know that what you say and do will affect us. And we have only one piece of advice for you, and that is a saying of our ancestors that in making decisions, you cannot make decisions for yourself or for your children, but every decision must be made for seven generations yet unborn. Mm-hmm. if we take that long-range view of the problems of the planet, and if we look back on how much progress we have made, I don't think there's any danger that we shall overcome. Martin Luther King was the prophet of the 20th century. He was a dreamer. But even in his time, if I had gone to him to say, on the road from Selma to Montgomery, "Martin, you know I want to be the mayor of Atlanta, and I want to be an ambassador to the United Nations, and I really would like to go to Congress too," he would have said, "Son, it's hot out here. Drink some water and sit down in the shade, because it ain't gonna be that easy." So whenever young people say, "Have you made any progress?" I said, "We've made, what would Martin Luther King think of our progress?" He would be shocked that we've come as far as we've come. But he would also be appalled if we tried to rest on our laurels. And he would say that you're moving in the right direction. As long as we can improve and increase understanding, as long as we can devote our science and our technology and our economic and our healthcare models to dealing with the problems of the least of these, and let's not forget those who are incarcerated. For jail is not an answer to anything. But you have the opportunity in this academic environment not only to study the problems of the world, but to plan the activities that can change the world without violence. You must be the scientists and the diplomats. You must develop the corporations. And remember, almost everybody that's doing something successful got in trouble for it. Bill Gates got fired because he wouldn't think about hardware. He got this notion of software. But 10 years later, the software was buying the hardware. Ted Turner talked about a global news network, and people thought he was crazy because he talked loud and he was very uncouth, and but he had a hearing problem. And it took him, he didn't realize why he was so loud till he made his first $1 billion. And then he gave it away to the UN. And you know, we are a part of a generation that believes that we can change the world. And never in human history has there been the commitment, the resources, the courage, the money, and the technology to make our dreams come true. And so we shall overcome, not someday, but we can overcome today. It's your decision.
Ambassador Young, I thank you for joining us at the table and for leading the conversation. Grateful. The candle to my left is a candle that was used in the darkest days of apartheid in South Africa. The barbed wire surrounding the light in that barbed wire represents the truth of God's peace and justice shining into the midst of that dark place. My name is Craig Coker, and on behalf of Duke Chapel and the Protestant community of Duke, and in the name of the Holy Trinity, I light this candle in the hopes that the light of God's peace would continue to shine in the dark and the healing and reconciling places of our own lives.
I'm Rabbi Michael Goldman. I'm the rabbi for Jewish life at Duke and the Jewish chaplain of the university. I light this candle in the name of the one who is the creator of the heaven and the earth, the fashioner of light and darkness, the one seated on the throne of justice and mercy, the bestower of judgment and grace, B'shem Hashem, Oseh Shamayim Va'aretz, Yotzer Or Uvarech Choshech, Hayoshev Al Kisot Din V'Rachamim, HaShofet V'Achanun. And I light this candle in the name of our tradition, which mandates us to take up the cause. As Rabbi Tarfon said, ours is not to finish the task, but we are not free to desist from it.
I'm Father Joe Vetter from the Catholic community at Duke, and I'm here to recommit our community and all of us to follow the teachings of our Lord Jesus, who commanded us to love one another and to respect each person.
My name is Wako, and on behalf of the Buddhist community at Duke, and in the name of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, I light this candle for peace, hope, and justice. A Zen verse of repentance says, all our ancient, twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through our bodies, speech, and mind, we now fully avow. May we eradicate the sickness of white supremacy and privilege. And may we liberate ourselves and one another from every fear and fetter that binds our hearts, our bodies, and our minds.
My name is John Stone Street, and on behalf of the Orthodox Christian community at Duke, I light this candle in tribute to Martin Luther King Jr.'s belief in the redemptive power of voluntary suffering.